Jimmy, do you realize we have been here 17 whole days? Why, in 17 days you can decide anything. That was President Harry S. Truman to then U.S. Secretary of State James Burns at Potsdam, 2nd August, 1945. Welcome to episode 105 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg Algonquin people, also called Ottawa, Canada. So last episode looked at the circumstances leading up to the Potsdam Conference, the third of the summit meetings that would include all three leaders of the Big Three, that is, the US, UK, and USSR. The US and UK both had new leaders by the second half of the 17-day conference in Potsdam, which was a small city outside Berlin, Germany. Franklin Roosevelt, who had been president of the U.S. since 1933 and steered it through the war, died on 12 April. His presidency passed to his vice president, Harry S. Truman, who had to learn a lot very fast to represent his country at Potsdam. And the United Kingdom had held its first general election since the outbreak of war in 1939. On 26 July 1945, midway through the Potsdam Conference, the results were announced. And Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister who had become the icon of stiff upper lip British resistance to the Nazi threat, lost. Clement Attlee became the new Prime Minister. Joseph Stalin was the one leader who remained constant in more ways than one. At the conference, he never diverted from his goals. The purpose of the conference was, ostensibly, to decide what to do in Europe after the defeat of the Nazis. Truman, Churchill, and Attlee wanted to develop a new order, a new relationship among the many countries of Europe who had fought on both sides during the war, in order to prevent another one from happening. Stalin agreed with these objectives, at least publicly. But as we saw last episode, and as will become even clearer in this one, he had some other plans as well. Domination of other countries, putting the nations of Eastern Europe under Soviet control in order to prevent another invasion of the Soviet Union from the West. If you haven't heard episode 104 yet, or if the hot weather, the smoke, the intense rainfall of the last 2 weeks have fogged your memory, go back and listen to it now. I'll wait. Okay, got it now? Good. Now, let's look at what they finally decided. Gathered in a luxurious setting, the former homes of German movie stars and producers, in vivid contrast to the situation of most Germans and Europeans in the immediate aftermath of the biggest war in history, the American, British, and Soviet delegations got to work and made a number of, well, maybe decisions is too strong a word. They made a lot of declarations. Now we're going to dive deep into the actual decisions or declarations made at the conference. Number one, first, the delegates decided to set up a council of foreign ministers to work out the details they couldn't or wouldn't or didn't want to get into at this particular summit. The makeup of the Council of Foreign Ministers is right in the name, and it included two nations not represented at Potsdam, France and China. This council would prepare a pre-settlement for Germany, which it would be obliged to agree to and implement. Next, the delegates at Potsdam worked out how Germany would be governed. It would be divided into four control zones under the USSR, USA, Britain, and France. At the Yalta Conference the previous February, the Big Three had decided on dividing Germany into three occupation zones. So, at Potsdam, France's occupation zone was taken from the US and UK areas. Stalin would not give up any ground. The occupiers would also denazify Germany. Actually, they had four D principles: denazification, democratization, disarmament, and demilitarization. In other words, they determined they would transform the German culture, or at least excise that cancerous part of it. Demilitarization also meant reducing or destroying all heavy industry that had any possible military application, including shipbuilding, machine building, and chemicals. They would direct Germany's economy toward light industry and agriculture. Point 3, reparations. At Yalta, the Allies had agreed that Germany would cede all manufacturing equipment, machinery and machine tools, railroad cars, locomotives, and ships to the Allies. Also to be transferred would be all investments abroad, all gold, silver, and platinum bullion and coins from any person or institution in Germany, all foreign currency, and all patents and research data. Wow. Germans would also do forced labor to the Allies. This part of the agreement would be administered by the Allied Reparations Committee. At Potsdam, the Soviets withdrew their objection to France joining the committee. In addition, 10% of the industrial capacity of the Western zones that were not necessary for Germany's peacetime economy would be transferred to the USSR within 2 years. So this is a major coup for the USSR. Point 4. All but 30 German submarines would be sunk, and the rest of the Kriegsmarine, that is the German Navy, would be divided among the big three, US, UK, USSR. The German merchant marine would also be divided up, and the three powers would share some of those ships to other allies following the defeat of Japan. So that wouldn't happen until Japan was defeated. Point 6. Yes, I know, I'm skipping number 5 for now, and the reason will be clear in a minute. Point 6 dealt with war criminals. The three governments reaffirmed their commitment to bringing those who had committed atrocities to swift and sure judgment. This set the stage for the subsequent Nuremberg trials. Declaration 7. British and American forces would enter Vienna, after which Austria's government would be decided. Austria would not pay any reparations. As it turned out, both the country and the capital city were divided among the four main allies, that is UK, US, USSR, and France, in similar way that Germany had been. Point 9. Skipping ahead again. The Potsdam Agreement delegated to the Council of Foreign Ministers the negotiation of peace treaties with Axis allied nations, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and Finland, and to find a way for them to join the United Nations. This point noted that Italy had, after 1943, fought on the side of the Allies, and therefore would be a candidate for UN membership after establishing a democratic government and institutions. Point 14. Don't worry, I'll come back to the ones I've skipped. Point number 14 stipulated that all Allied troops would withdraw immediately from Tehran. British and Soviet forces had invaded Iran during the war to safeguard a critical year-round route for lend-lease supplies. Point 15 declared that the city of Tangier, Morocco, would remain an international zone. Point 16 renewed commitment to the Montreux Convention, declaring that the Black Sea Straits to the Mediterranean port would remain open to international shipping and under the supervision of Turkey, or Turkey. 0.17 covered international inland waterways, such as the Danube and Rhine rivers, declaring them open to navigation. Now, let's go back to those points I skipped over. And I did that because they involve territory in some way. So, point 10. Italy's former colonies would be decided in negotiations of the Council of Foreign Ministers, eventually signed at the Paris Peace Conference in 1947. 11. The Allied Control Commission would have greater input into the restructuring of Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. Point 12. The Allies attempted to deal with the millions of displaced persons. These are refugees fleeing the fighting, those whose homes and whole towns had been destroyed, people fleeing either the Nazis or the Communists or both, people whom the Nazis had dragged into forced labor, and more. They were crowding the highways and streets of Europe, all going either back home or far away. The polite language of the conference declared that ethnic German populations would be transferred from areas within Russia, the Baltic nations, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and so on, to Germany in an, quote, orderly and humane manner, end quote. But really, this was ethnic cleansing, intended to remove inter-ethnic conflicts that had characterized much of the interwar period. Now to Poland. This was the most contentious issue. Remember how Poland had been the casus belli for the UK and France in 1939? Remember how the Polish government in exile settled in London during the war and helped coordinate intelligence gathering? Remember how the Polish Home Army, the Armia Krajowa, supplied the best intelligence on Eastern Europe to London throughout the war? Remember the Polish pilots who fought the Luftwaffe during the Battle of Britain? Polish soldiers who took part in Operation Market Garden? Remember the Warsaw Rising that saw the Germans brutally suppress, then level the city, while the Red Army sat by and not only refused to help, but actively interfered in Allied support? Remember Churchill's high-minded statements about how necessary Poland was to Britain, how it had to have a free, independent, and democratic existence after the war? Well, that didn't happen. Stalin and most Russians saw an independent Poland as an existential threat. After all, Poland had defeated the USSR in a war in 1920. Also, Poland was the route that both Napoleon and Hitler's forces had followed in their invasions. Poland hadn't exactly been an angel in the interwar years either. During the time, they had sporadically oppressed the Ukrainian minority in eastern Poland, the area around Lviv, which they called Lvov. And Poland had taken advantage of the chaos after the Munich Agreement in 1938 to take a chunk of Czechoslovakia. At the Tehran Conference in 1943, Churchill and Roosevelt had agreed with Stalin that the border between Poland and the USSR would be the so-called Curzon Line, the border that Molotov and Nazi Foreign Minister Ribbentrop had agreed on in 1939, which meant that Poland would lose Western Ukraine and Lviv to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Now, to be fair, to be accurate, there were a lot of ethnic Polish people in that section. It was not a clear, easy ethnic division. During the Potsdam Conference, Churchill continued to argue Poland's case, although he accepted the Curzon Line border. After all, he had helped negotiate that position at Tehran. But Stalin insisted on more territorial concessions. And with a huge army on the ground and in firm control of all of Eastern Europe up to Berlin and even farther, it was hard to argue with him. So this is what happened. Instead of a free Poland under the elected Polish government in exile, Poland would be governed by the Communist Provisional Government of National Unity, controlled by Moscow. Southeastern Poland, including Lvov, became the Western Ukraine around Lviv. that wasn't the only territory that Poland lost compared to its borders in 1939. You can see that in the geographic changes in map 2 on the webpage for this episode. Stalin insists on transferring large areas into its Soviet republics of Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine, all of which he intended to keep. This included Vilno, now Vilnius, capital of Lithuania, and a large swath of valuable agricultural land that went to the Baltic territories. When Western allies objected, Stalin retorted, "Did your army liberate Poland, Mr. Churchill? Did your army liberate Poland, Mr. President?" Of course, the Poles did not necessarily think of the Red Army's activities as liberation. Now, Stalin was not completely unreasonable. In compensation for all this territory in the east, Poland received a huge chunk of formerly German territory, that is, territory within the borders of pre-war Germany. Half of East Prussia, mostly populated by ethnic Germans, went to Poland. The other half, including the fortified city of Königsberg, became the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland also acquired the so-called Free City of Danzig, now Gdansk, an important port on the Baltic Sea. Poland's western border with Germany shifted west of the Nisa and Oder rivers. This meant Lower and Upper Silesia, Pomerania, Posen, East Brandenburg, and other territories became part of Poland. Net result? A loss of 73,739 square kilometers or 28,471 square miles from Poland. This is roughly the area of today's Czech Republic. Worse was the loss of people. In 1945 and 46, millions of ethnic Poles left the areas transferred from those formerly Polish territories within the new Soviet boundaries. That process had already begun as soon as Operation Bagration carried the Red Army into Poland. In 1944, the Soviets forced 117,212 Poles westward. In 1945, another 742,631, and in 1946, another 640,000. Meanwhile, millions of Germans, Ukrainians, Belarusians, Lithuanians, and others left the new Polish areas. A few years after the Potsdam Conference, President Harry Truman recounted this memory. "I remember at Potsdam, we got to discussing a matter in eastern Poland, and it was remarked by the Prime Minister of Great Britain that the Pope would not be happy over the arrangement of that Catholic end of Poland. And the Generalissimo, the Prime Minister of Russia, leaned on the table, and he pulled his mustache like that, and he looked over to Mr. Churchill and said, 'Mr. Churchill, Mr. Prime Minister, how many divisions did you say the Pope had?'" End quote. Of course, the Polish government in exile objected to this change, this wholesale rearrangement, the redefinition of their country. Not only had they not participated in the conference, had nothing to say about all this, they had just been eviscerated. They were gone. The Polish leader, Stanisław Mikołajczyk, resigned on the spot. Churchill, for his part, the great defender of Poland, called his former ally ungrateful, and Poland's refusal to accept these terms a threat to future peace and security. Seeing this compromise as necessary to a successful outcome of the conference and to avoiding a Third World War, Churchill said to the head of the Polish government in exile, quote, "I wash my hands of Poland. As far as I am concerned, we shall give the business up. Because of quarrels between Poles, we are not going to wreck the peace of Europe. In your obstinacy, you do not see what is at stake." End quote. However, many American and British delegates balked at this decision. U.S. Ambassador to Poland Arthur Bliss Lane called it, quote, "a policy of appeasement," end quote, evoking the memory of the Munich Agreement about Czechoslovakia in 1938. After the conference, with their control over Poland firm, the Soviets arrested 100,000 anti-communist Poles. They also arrested 16 members of the Home Army during an August mission to Moscow. "Yeah, come over here, let's talk, you're under arrest." Right. As we know now, Polet never gave up his desire for freedom and finally achieved it in 1989, 44 years later. Poland would not be the only country in Eastern Europe to have new borders after the war. Let's look into that after the break. Back in a moment. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian man, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941, just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. It comes in three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War. The Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941, through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase the three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon is another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halbe Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome to part two of episode 105 of Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of World War II. Today we're looking at the decisions or declarations that came out of the Potsdam Conference of July and August 1945 and how they shaped the Europe we know today. How borders changed after the end of the war. Poland was not the only country to lose territory. Hungary lost area it had gained from Yugoslavia as well as northern Transylvania to Romania. Romania itself ceded Bessarabia and northern Bukovina to the Soviet Union, and that territory is once again disputed today in 2026. Germany lost a great deal of territory, about 25% of its pre-1937 base. This led to the forced expulsion of more than 10 million ethnic Germans from land ceded to Poland, Russia, Ukraine, Lithuania, Czechoslovakia, and others. The biggest loss, though, was East Germany. After the war, Germany was divided into four occupation zones: Soviet, American, British, and French. In 1949, the American, British, and French occupation zones became the Federal Republic of Germany, with their capital in Bonn. An independent country, more or less. Still dependent on the West for quite a long time. But the Soviets kept their grip on their eastern occupied territory. When the Federal Republic, or West Germany, became official as a sovereign entity on 23rd May 1949, the German Democratic Republic, DDR, or East Germany, became nominally sovereign on 7 October. It was still controlled by Moscow and was known as one of the most restrictive police states in the world. This situation persisted until the Berlin Wall fell in 1990 and Germany reunited. Map 3 shows the changes in German borders and the territories over the years. And then, of course, there's the story of the Berlin Wall. Well, that will have to wait for another future episode. The Potsdam Conference ended on 2nd June 1945 with a number of resolutions. Most of them were reaffirmations of decisions or declarations reached at Yalta or at earlier conferences. Several of the points passed on final decisions and details to later meetings of the Council of Foreign Ministers, including a final peace settlement for Germany, which they got down to it, they nailed it down in 1990. The Potsdam Agreement did not mention the Holocaust or anything about Jewish people in Europe. It's important to note that the participants did not call the Potsdam Conference a peace conference. Before it started, Stalin said its purpose would be to set up a future peace conference. Quote, "Not calling Potsdam a peace conference suited everyone's interests. No peace conference meant no treaty for the new president to press through the Senate. Although Truman faced far less opposition than president in 1919 Woodrow Wilson had, he did not relish the idea of tangling with his old colleagues in the Senate. Like his British and Soviet counterparts, he was content to pass the heavy diplomatic work of negotiating the details onto the Council of Foreign Ministers, who finalized treaties with Italy, Finland, Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria in a series of meetings held from September 11, 1945 to December 12, 1946. End quote from Michael Niebuhr's book, Potsdam. The Americans left Potsdam feeling they had achieved what they wanted to. They were withdrawing their armed forces from Europe, which alarmed the British, partly in order to build up for the final battles in the Pacific, but also because their men wanted to come home. And I know what you're thinking. Soon, the U.S. will drop atomic bombs on Japan, and the Cold War will start. But in early August 1945, the Americans were not looking forward to more conflict with the USSR, unlike Churchill, who thought there should be a war. He called that Operation Unthinkable. Anyway, the Americans believed that the future promised greater cooperation and trade with the Soviet Union. the Soviets had agreed to join the United Nations. Whether its membership and the way it passed through today's Russia is positive or negative for the world is a topic for another podcast. And as for security, at the opening of the Potsdam Conference, Truman knew that the United States had a secret, devastating weapon, the atomic bomb, before the conference officially opened. And Truman received notification of that. What Truman didn't know was that Stalin knew all about the atomic bomb. The British, though, were pessimistic about the future, and they had a lot to be pessimistic about. The British Empire had been on the brink of bankruptcy at the beginning of the war, and their cities had suffered a lot of damage from German air raids and missiles. The war had cost them most of their gold reserves as well. Britain suffered about 450,000 casualties, military and civilian, by 1945. After 1945, the UK would be dependent on the American Marshall Plan. More on that in the future. Also, independent movements in Britain's global colonies were powerful and gaining strength, especially in India, the jewel in the crown, to quote a 1980s TV series. The Soviets were the most pleased about Potsdam, even smug. Remember, they dominated Eastern Europe. They had taken territories from Germany and Poland. They had installed puppet governments in Poland and would soon in Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. At this point, in 1945, it seemed that Tito and Yugoslavia would continue to toe their line. In Asia, they knew they would take Sakhalin Island from the Japanese and had Truman's promise that the U.S. would not oppose them in capturing the Kuril Islands. In Europe, they controlled a quarter of Germany, and while the other powers had their zones of control in Berlin, those were surrounded by the Red Army. The Soviets could also look forward to getting all those machine tools, ships, and other reparations from Germany. While the British and Americans were withdrawing their troops from Europe, the Red Army remained, and it was by far, by several factors, the largest army around. Oh, and that new atomic bomb, the wonder weapon of the Americans? The Americans and British wanted to keep it secret. But when that test at Alamogordo proved its viability, Truman told Stalin at Potsdam that the U.S. had tested a new bomb of, quote, extraordinarily destructive power, end quote. The Soviets had had spies within the Manhattan Project for years, and Stalin and the security chief, Lavrenti Beria, knew all about the atomic bomb. So on hearing Truman's words, Stalin said, quote, a new bomb of extraordinary power, probably decisive on the Japanese. What a bit of luck, end quote. And don't forget, the Soviet Union was hard at work on developing its own atomic weapons too. But that is also a story for another episode. To sum up the story of the Potsdam Conference, I'll again turn to Michael Nieberg. Quote, as the fate of Poland showed, Eastern Europe paid the price of the Potsdam Agreement. As the Western statesmen at Potsdam knew, they could do nothing to stop the Soviets from dominating the region, short of starting another war. They knew that their victory over Germany had been a coalition victory. End quote. Thank you for listening to episode 105 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast focusing on the full story of the Eastern Front of the Second World War. So you'll find maps and photos on the webpage for this episode. Just go to beyondbarbarossa.ca and click on episode 105. Please, if you liked it or even if you didn't, consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app and giving it a rating on whatever podcasting platform you use. That helps tell other people about the fact that we exist. A review, whatever you feel, would also make a big difference. I'd like to say a special thank you and a shout out to all who subscribe to Beyond Barbarossa through Patreon. Patreon supporters get episodes early and ad-free and with images. Until all Ukrainians can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. So if you'd like to support them and this podcast, go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support you feel comfortable with. Would you like to add anything, a question, a comment, or I hope not, but a correction? Please send it in. I love hearing from listeners. Reach me by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You can also reach me on all the other social media. You can find Scott Burry Author or Scott the Writer on Blue Sky, TikTok, Instagram, and most of the other social media, except for X, because it's awful. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina, vive le Canada!